Our next speaker, keeping in the tradition of other great scholars like Murray Rothbard, is a scholar of just tremendous range. History, economics, politics, a two-time best-selling author, currently the author of Meltdown, which is a number one New York Times bestseller, and just a complete gem. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Tom Woods.
Thank you, guys. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Jesse. Meltdown was a New York Times bestseller. It did not get to number one. However, you know, you can always, you know, on your way out, you can try. Well, it's a great honor to be here and to speak at an event in which we are celebrating Ron Paul. And the only time I don't listen to Ron Paul is when he says not to talk about him. So I am going to say a brief word. One of the things I like most about him is that he doesn't believe what he was taught in the seventh grade. So he doesn't believe all the propaganda that the drones in our drone factories are taught day in and day out. And the resulting personality type is one that more or less assumes that the government is there for his own good, and that really, if left to ourselves, we'd all crumble into anarchy. That's just terrible. But so, for example, I think we all know how the typical American history textbook tells a story, don't we? The first part would be that for a long time we had people who believed in something called states' rights or the Tenth Amendment or local self-government. And these were all stupid, evil people. You know, these were all people who, for some reason, didn't trust their overlords in Washington and thought that they ought to control their own affairs. No, these were bad people, and really all they were interested in was slavery and segregation. There's no reason other than that anyone could possibly support the powers of the states. Well, it turns out if you look in American history, you find that people use the concepts of states' rights in order to defend free speech, to defend peace, to defend free trade, and in fact, to defend the fight against slavery. In fact, Thomas Jefferson in 1798 said the unsayable when he drafted the Kentucky Resolutions and said, the federal government has only the powers granted to it, the states retain all powers not granted to it, and if that federal government tries to exercise a power it hasn't been given, then the states should refuse to enforce it and nullify that law, said Jefferson. Now, of course, if you try to put this point of view forth, you know, well, you're some kind of an extremist, there's something the matter with you, maybe you need some sort of psychological evaluation. Well, that's when I always like to remind our opponents that this was, after all, Thomas freaking Jefferson. I mean, it's not like I just pulled this out of... Right? That they don't want. That they do not want. They don't want you to know that Thomas Jefferson thought that, or that for 10 years people had been thinking things like that ever since the Virginia Ratifying Convention promised Virginians that that new federal government cannot go beyond the powers that, according to the Virginia Ratifying Convention, were expressly delegated to it. So don't worry that the federal government will misuse the General Welfare Clause or anything like that. So people were assured that Virginia would be exonerated from it if this federal government should go beyond its legitimate powers. Now, as I say, today, well, this is, you know, no one could possibly hold a view like that, well, except Thomas Jefferson and the entire Virginia political tradition. But this is, we cannot allow the ears of our gentle little children to be soiled with these ideas. No, sir, this is subversive. We can't give people ideas. No. You just do what the Harvard PhDs in Washington want you to do. Just shut your mouths. And there is no way to resist them. That's the story we get told. So states' rights is terrible. There's no reason you'd ever have recourse to it. Or secondly, this is one of my favorites. I think we all learned this. In the 19th century, we had a free market economy in which the economy was totally dominated by evil monopolists who exploited everybody. And they jacked prices up. And everybody was working for 3 cents an hour. And people had to crawl around eating dirt and searching for worms for sustenance. And the economy was dominated by short little men with white mustaches carrying around sacks of money with dollar signs on them. I think we all got this, right? Now, I think the lesson here is not too subtle. Well, obviously, your wise overlords need to come rescue you from this terrible, terrible outcome. Well, again, this is also a whole lot of propaganda, and I won't bore this room with the details, but the bottom line is this is just total nonsense. If you look at people like Andrew Carnegie, I don't think he's a bad guy. If steel rails go down by 90% in price, that pretty much makes everything cheaper, makes our lives easier. Why am I supposed to be more afraid of him than I am of the freaking U.S. president who has control over the military and every other aspect of the U.S. government? Why am I supposed to be afraid of some guy who makes steel? Why is that the big enemy? But in the schools, that's what you're taught. This is a terrible old private sector, and all these public-spirited officials who are there for the common good are going to protect you from them. Or another favorite, the Federal Reserve System. Well, that was created to stabilize the economy, right? Smooth out business cycles, give us a stable currency, be a lender of last resort. Okay, so it can do one thing. Yeah. But in fact, if anything, I'm overstating the case, because I bet you most of us in school never heard anything about the Federal Reserve one way or the other, right? It's not that we heard some propaganda view. We didn't hear a thing, right? And if you raise it with your teacher, well, immediately you're going to change the subject because the teacher has no idea what on God's green earth you are talking about. However, if you were in the advanced class, there's a chance that you did get at least some mention of the Federal Reserve. But again, it's portrayed, and I've seen it portrayed in textbooks, as a wonderful device by which the experts apply scientific management to the supply of money. And this is how we prevent depressions from occurring. Now, of course, we try to pass over that little bump that 16 years after the Federal Reserve Act, you know, we got the beginning of the Great Depression. So we're supposed to think, oh, sorry, everybody. Just a little mistake there, sorry. We're just getting our feet wet here. Gave you the worst depression in all of American history. Sorry about that. Sorry. And so we get told that without the Fed, think of what we have. We'd have the terrible 19th century when we had all these financial panics, right? And good thing we have the Fed to rescue us from that. So, now, again, what's the lesson here? Well, without our wise overlords in charge of the money supply, well, you know, again, we'd all be in terrible shape and this and that. Well, again, with a crowd like this, I don't want to bore you about 19th century financial panics. But if you look at them, they're pretty much all caused by pretty much the same causes. I mean, there is no Federal Reserve System at that time, but there are crummy government-established national banks. There are bank bailouts, implicit and explicit. And in fact, we're told that in the 1870s, we had the Long Depression. Ooh, that's supposed to make us think, oh, we don't want another Long Depression, so we better have a gigantic Fed to help us get out of it. Well, it turns out that economic historians don't even believe there was a Long Depression anymore. They actually now believe that in 1873 you had a little recession, and then the rest of the decade was actually one of the most, combined with the 1880s, one of the most prosperous periods in all of American history, by all the metrics you can measure it by. And one of the reasons people thought we had a depression was that we've all been propagandized into believing that if prices fall, this is the worst outcome imaginable, right? Falling prices, we can't have that. Well, we had falling prices, 3.8% a year during the 1870s. People thought, oh my goodness, commentators later thought this must have been a terrible depression. As a matter of fact, consumers kind of liked prices going down 3.8% a year. I don't think a lot of you buy like a new computer product and then you go up to the register and find out, actually, the product is on sale. It's even less. I don't think you indignantly say, well, now, wait a minute. There's no way I'm paying less for this. That would be deflation. I can't let that happen. Before you know it, we'll have a deflationary spiral, and we'll all be back to crawling around searching for worms. We can't have that. No. But this is what we get taught, and it's complete 100% propaganda. Or then, the last one I'll talk about before moving on to other things. The New Deal and the Great Depression. Okay, we all heard that we had the Great Depression, and then we had stupid old Herbert Hoover, big old Herbert Hoover, who was too much of a doofus to do anything about the Great Depression, and because of him, it just got worse and worse. And then FDR came in and magically did things that got us out of it. And then even if you don't accept that, well, World War II got us out of it, because if you build a lot of things that you're then going to blow up, this will make you wealthy. Now, everyone believes this, too. But again, what do these things have in common? Is this just a coincidence that when we learn history in a government drone center, that the version of history they teach us happens to flatter our overlords at every turn? And so I'm not proposing that there's some sort of secret meeting at which all the textbook authors gather and they smoke cigars. We don't have that anymore. Wait, pardon me. Right, we don't have smoke-filled rooms anymore. In a very clean air room, they all gather and say, how can we enslave the little kiddies to us? How can we write these textbooks to really get them? I'm not saying that, but what I am saying is that if they did do that, the textbooks would be exactly the same as they are now. Now, one of the topics that Ron Paul has helped open up for us again is the topic of money. This is supposed to be off the table. We peons aren't even entitled to an opinion on money. The experts are in charge of this. You just shut up and go about your life. Don't pay any attention. Now, one thing you can say about the 19th century is that at least then people did feel like they were entitled to an opinion. People wrote about monetary policy. They wrote about greenbacks, and they wrote about silver, and they wrote about gold, and they wrote pamphlets and books. They thought they were entitled to an opinion. Well, they learned in the 20th century they are not. The experts will run things, citizen. All you need to do is accept their direction. Well, Ron Paul sort of has been putting his hand up in the back for years, saying, you know what, I'm not so sure that's altogether right. I think in a way that's kind of an insult to the American people. But beyond that, he's been suggesting that maybe there's something wrong with the money. That maybe this isn't just a matter of our economy just goes in these inexplicable cycles of boom and bust, and no one knows the answer. I guess it's all just because of greed. Greed must be causing these boom-bust cycles. No one bothers to ask, well, how come greed seems to appear in sudden cyclical clusters? Like what? If greed were the explanation, why aren't we always in a depression? Right? I mean, how could that be? I've actually heard it said by historians of the 1920s that the Great Depression of 1929 was caused by the fact that we had tax cuts earlier in the 1920s. And the tax cuts led to the wealthy having too much money, and they spent their money badly, and we got the Depression. And the argument is that there was too much of a wealth disparity. The poor didn't have enough of the wealth. The wealthy had too much. There have been far more times in American and world history in which you've had a far greater disparity between rich and poor, and you had no depression following from it. Almost any country on earth, you'll find that this is the way the wealth proportion goes, and you don't constantly have a depression. But if that were the case, that this is what causes them, we'd always be in them. No, Ron Paul wants to suggest that maybe there's another factor, and maybe it's not the greedy people in the private sector causing it. Maybe it, in fact, has to do with a government-granted monopoly. Because that is, in fact, what the Federal Reserve exercises, and without that government-granted monopoly, it would be nothing. So he's suggesting that even though the New York Times and Newsweek don't want to talk about paper money as being one of our problems, it might be one of our problems all the same. Maybe the New York Times and Newsweek are missing something. This is possible. And yet we're told a lot of times by the neocons that, oh, no. I mean, we're with you on spending. Yeah. We're with you on spending, but this whole money thing, look, that battle is over, man. You've got to just get used to living with paper money. Well, you know what? I don't want to get used to living with paper money, and I'll just give you a few reasons, not that people in this room need to know. But, for example, before we had irredeemable paper money, that if you return it and say, okay, I'd like to redeem this $20 bill, they'll give you another $20 bill. They're not going to give you an ounce of gold. But back when we had a money that was actually gold and silver. The paper represented gold or represented silver. You could actually save for the future by piling up your coins. That's all you had to do. You could save by piling up gold and silver coins because those coins, at that time, when they were money, they gained in value year after year. So you save for the future. All you have to do is accumulate coins. Who in his right mind is going to save for the future today by piling up crummy Federal Reserve notes? Of course, no one. Because by the time you retire, they won't be worth a thing. The Federal Reserve System, as you know, has destroyed the value of the dollar such that it's lost 95% of its value since the Fed was founded. And the Fed says we're the great inflation fighter. I'd hate to see what would happen if they weren't fighting against inflation. How does this affect the average person? The average person can't save so easily anymore because his purchasing power is going to just fly away. So what's he have to do? He's got to go into the financial markets. He's got to get into the stock market. He's got to invest just to try to break even, just to hang on to his nest egg. Well, what if the stock market goes south? Then he's ruined. Now, this is not something that you had to live with before the glorious 20th century. But this is what we have to live with now. We have the fact that every single known hyperinflation, where the inflation is, and we arbitrarily define hyperinflation as 50% inflation per month, every single example of that comes from a paper money. And in fact, we all know the German hyperinflation, 1923. My favorite story from that involves a guy who had his life savings in the bank, 68,000 marks. That was a small fortune. Then the hyperinflation hit. He gets a letter from his bank. And the letter says, we're closing your account. Unfortunately, the smallest denomination bill in circulation now is 1,000,000 marks. So we've rounded up your 68,000 mark deposit. We've rounded it up to 1,000,000. And there's a check for that amount enclosed in an envelope whose stamp cost 5,000,000 marks. And that ruined him. Every example of this that has ever happened has occurred under the type of monetary regime we have now. We have the fact that we hear a lot of shedding of tears about moral hazard. Moral hazard refers to this phenomenon by which people act in an artificially risky way because they expect that any losses they incur will be borne by some sucker, not by themselves. Well, the very existence of the Federal Reserve promotes moral hazard because every major Wall Street actor knows that if things go sour for him, there is no physical limit, as there would be under gold or any precious metal. There's no physical limit to the amount of money that can be created out of thin air to bail him out. And in fact, that's what central banks do. They bail people out. They don't bail out average people. They bail out their buddies. You and I are not their buddies. But this feeds into moral hazard. This is the problem. If you try to get rid of moral hazard without going after its source, which is paper money, then what you're going to wind up doing is saying, we need more regulation here, and more regulation there, and more regulation there. That's what's going to be the outcome if you don't go after the root source. You're going to have, as my friend Guido Holtzman puts it, oh, sure, you'll have order. You'll have an orderly economy, but it'll be the order that you find in a cemetery. There'll be no life left in it. You will have squeezed it all out. So if you try to get rid of moral hazard without going after the root cause, paper money, what you will start to see gradually being introduced is a Soviet-style central plan. There is no alternative to this. And finally, the business cycle itself, the very fact that our economy seems to go up and down, up and down. Now, we all know the unfortunate fact that Paul Krugman won the Nobel Prize in Economics last year because the prize, like the dollar, has seen better days, but nevertheless, that doesn't mean that it was meaningless when F.A. Hayek won the Nobel Prize in 1974, because, you know, you might say, oh, good, F.A. Hayek, wonderful, but you might say, you know, big deal, Hayek wins the prize. I mean, you know, this bum Krugman won it, so what does it matter? Well, Krugman and these others, they win it for saying things the Nobel Committee already wants to hear. Hayek wins it for saying the exact opposite of what they want to hear. Hayek wins it for saying, you know what, maybe central banks are not our saviors after all. Let's consider that forbidden notion for just a second here. Let's move out of seventh grade for 5 seconds and consider that our wise overlords may be causing the problem. That's not exactly what the Nobel Committee wants to hear. So if he wins the prize, he's really on to something here. And he explains how these central banks, with their monetary policy, in effect get our economies on these unsustainable sugar highs that eventually culminate in a crash. It is inevitable, and yet every time it happens, the so-called experts stand there scratching their heads saying, I have no idea how this could have happened. Well, I know somebody who knows how it could have happened, and I know somebody who's been warning us that it's going to happen, and of course it's Ron Paul. Now, one thing I love about this whole situation we're in is that, and now look, I have some friends who would identify themselves as being on the left, and they're very dear people to me. But at the same time, having said that, let me now condemn the rest of them by pointing out that if only they lived by their own slogans. The most famous left-wing slogan I can recall is question authority. Now, if only they lived by that. If only they lived by that dictum, question authority. Question authority seems to mean, you know, question your parish priest or something, and then you just leave it at that. But by question authority, they mean, yeah, question authority, but, you know, We can't extend that to the, you know, the Fed or the Treasury Secretary or the SEC or the medical establishment or the bipartisan foreign policy consensus or the Washington Post or the official version of American history we were all taught in fourth grade. No, not that. Well, you know what? That's really not that helpful to us right now. We actually need people who are going to ask serious rather than boneheaded and trivial questions. We need people who are going to say, maybe we should ask if we need a Fed, instead of saying, we need a nicer Fed, we just need to reform the Fed, or maybe the Fed is just fine as it is. We need people to say, maybe this institution is not necessary. We need to question existing institutions, and the left isn't doing it, we're the ones doing it. Just consider the very fact that today you can, all around the country, join a local End the Fed chapter. I mean, did any of us think that was going to happen in our lifetimes? Yeah, I better see what my local End the Fed chapter is up to. I mean, well, this is unbelievable. Amazing that this is occurring. And again, it's been made possible by Ron Paul. Let me say, for the record, which I've said repeatedly, because when I'm wrong, I want to admit I'm wrong, I was so wrong on this. When in the presidential campaign, Ron Paul started talking about monetary policy and the Fed, I thought he was making a big mistake. People aren't going to understand this. It's going to go way over their heads. Let's focus on things that the public can get. Boy, thank goodness no one ever listens to me, you know? Thank goodness. Because this was one of the best services he could perform for us. Because the typical politician, you know, has his focus groups and he finds out, hey, you know, what are the rubes out there interested in? I'll give them the red meat they're looking for. Ron Paul instead thinks, well, here's what we should be thinking about, and I'm going to talk to you about it. This is a completely new breed of person, really, in the political world. And he was so right, and I was so wrong. And so, you know, it's humbling. But I'm glad to admit this, because, man, has he done us a service. Because now it's possible to entertain questions like, again, I focus on the Fed because of the audit of the Fed bill, and this is on our minds, but should we have this institution at all? Now, last month, Gene Epstein and I were in a debate in Las Vegas that C-SPAN covered. We were debating, should we abolish the Fed? I mean, nobody was debating this 3 years ago, certainly not 10 or years or more, and yet suddenly this is almost like, it's almost like cool to be anti-Fed now, right? I mean, if somebody is pro-Fed, you think, what kind of a stooge are you, right? My favorite little bit, though, if I may share this with you, Ron Paul's on a TV thing, I think it's CNBC, now don't take my punchline, please, if you know it, all right? He's on a CNBC thing, and he's with some almost scared-looking kid, you know, who's a misnamed progressive, even though he favors the totally regressive Fed. I don't know why they call him a progressive, but they do. So they got the host, whose job is just to keep the conversation going without really knowing what anyone's talking about. And then you got Ron Paul and then this other person. So like a Brady Bunch kind of thing on the screen. So Ron Paul is saying, you know, just saying, well, you know, Congressman Paul, I mean, surely you're not saying we need to get rid of the Fed altogether, right? Oh, no, that's exactly what I'm saying. I think we need to abolish it. Needs to just go, you know, the sort of thing no one's ever heard on television before. And the look of sheer terror on the kid's face, like, what? 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 And so instead of saying, well, you know, instead of thinking, huh, you know what? Instead of just taking the Fed for granted, I should live up to what I'm supposed to believe in and question these things, he instead said, well, but if you got rid of the Fed, I mean, it would be like throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, you know, sure, we don't like Greenspan or whatever, but we can't just throw. And so I thought to myself, gosh, that is such a great, interesting confrontation that we just watch on TV. And so sure enough, I was on this radio show in Ohio, and it's one of my favorite moments in all the times I've done a radio show. The guy said the same thing to me. The radio host said, you know, you make a lot of good arguments against the Fed, but I have this fear that you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, if you get rid of the Fed, isn't that what you're doing? And I said, well, you want to throw out the baby with the bathwater if it's a demon baby, right? Now, we talked, today I've been talking about propaganda and history. I don't need to talk to you about propaganda and the economy because we're surrounded by it, so we can skip that section. But I will say that I'm grateful to Congressman Paul. He wrote the foreword for my book, Meltdown, that came out this year, talking about explaining, giving a free market overview of what happened to us, explaining it so that the other side can't just get away with the old thing of, well, the free market failed, you're all a bunch of stupid rubes for believing in it, and now your overlords need more power. I wanted to give an alternative to that. And the very fact that there's an interest in this, that my point of view, which would be considered radical, is getting a fair hearing, it's because Ron Paul blazed the trail. I mean, that's, you know, there's no way I can deny that. I wouldn't want to deny that. I'm thrilled that he's made this all possible. That now, finally, we have a hearing. We have young people listening. Young people don't want to be stooges. That's the last thing they want to be. They want to be on the cutting edge. Now, wait a minute. Now, you're thinking, wait a minute. What about all those Obama drones who just go out there and, you know, whatever Obama says, I'll support. All right. I take that back. There are some young people who want to be drones. However, the thinking young people, the ones who actually can change history, are people who are insulted by what they see around them, by young people who think, I just do whatever the wise leader tells me to do. I pledge allegiance to our wise leader. No. They want to ask questions. They respect a man who's turning 74, who looks them in the eye and tells them the truth. They know it's the truth. This is what they respect. They don't respect the drones. And we are reaching these young people. For the first time, we are actually getting to them. And we're not going to know what the results are of what Ron Paul has done for 5, 10 years maybe, because the fruits of it are still so young, we don't know what they're going to do with their lives yet. They haven't even graduated, half of them. But wait till they do. Economics departments will never be the same, but so many other aspects of our society will never be the same, because the bright kids, the drones don't make history. The kids who actually have a vision, who believe in something, they make history. And Ron Paul is the leader who has made it possible for us even to consider that the future could be different from the present. Instead of just thinking fatalistically that, you know, I guess we're just going to keep going through our lives and everything we believe in is just going to keep being trampled and no one's going to champion and then we're just going to die and that's it. For the first time, I feel like maybe that's not our future. And it's because of him. And I want to leave you with this one favor I want to ask you to do for me. Even though you don't owe me any favors, I'm going to ask you to do one anyway. And then if you ever need me to do something, you know, you just give me a call, okay? And that is, there is a fantastic documentary that's about to come out next month about the Ron Paul campaign. And you might think, yeah, you know, documentary, schmockumentary, but now wait a minute, now hang on a minute. This one is, we've already seen a couple trailers from it. This takes us from the very beginnings all the way through the campaign, and we revisit a lot of those episodes that you and I remember, some of these glorious, wonderful months of our lives that we spent together fighting in this cause. It's something that we can be energized by, that we can learn from. And one of the episodes, in fact, what I'd like to do is go to YouTube and look it up. The video is called For Liberty. So just do For Liberty trailer. Or even easier, I posted it on my website, so you can just go click on it. Watch this YouTube. My website's tomwoods.com. Watch this YouTube. Rate it. Give it 5 stars. Because it starts with, I think, one of my favorite episodes. When we first saw how powerful we were in Iowa. You remember they had that candidates forum? And they weren't going to let Ron Paul participate because he wasn't a credible candidate. However, Tommy Thompson was a credible candidate, according to them. Jim Gilmore, anybody even remember this guy? He was a credible candidate. We can't have Ron Paul come to our anti-tax convention. So I said, that's like not inviting Batman to your anti-Riddler convention. And so what did we all do? We had our own event next door, and that event with one candidate had twice as many people as an event with like 8 candidates. And that began to send the message that, you know, you can put up all these drones as candidates, these interchangeable drones, but the thinking population is waking up, and we had far too much fun educating Americans for us to just look back at a documentary like this and say, well, those were some fun times. They were. But let's make sure we have even more glorious times in the future. So thank you all very much.
ladies and gentlemen, I would just like to let you know that we were just absolutely overwhelmed and humbled by how many people have come out, and we know that there are going to be a lot of people out in the hallways that are going to be unable to properly hear our next guest, and everybody wants to hear the next guest, Judge Andrew Napolitano. So he has graciously agreed that after he's done speaking here, he's going to go down to the main barbecue room, and we're letting people in there right now, and so he's going to speak to some other folks again for a couple minutes. So we really are doing everything we can to make sure that everybody gets to hear the judge. Ladies and gentlemen, Judge Napolitano is down here today supporting Ron Paul, and he supports all of us every day on the airwaves, and now he could use a little help and support from us. A few of you out there might have seen a little show called Freedom Watch. You guys ever see that? Well, we got some big news. Starting September 14th, and y'all are the first people to hear this, starting September 14th, Freedom Watch is going to be on every day, 4:30 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. We all got to tune in, give support, and email Fox News. Let them know over at foxnews.com that you appreciate them having the judge on, because he is taking off. He is going to be all over the place. FoxNews.com, 4:30 to 5, every day. You guys got to tune in. And I don't think our next guest needs very much introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, Judge Andrew Napolitano.
I hate to speak last. I have to follow two giants. Lou Rockwell has done more to cement the intellectual foundations of the movement for liberty than anybody else today. And Tom Woods has explained in his runaway easy-to-read bestseller, Meltdown, how we got in this mess better than anybody else today. I was speaking to a group not unlike this about 7 or 8 years ago, and in the audience was a great man, and I didn't know it. And in the middle of giving one of my favorite quotations by Thomas Jefferson, I looked in the third row, and I met this man, eye to eye, face to face, for the first time, and it was Ron Paul. And I said, I don't know what inspired me to say this, but it stuck, and I'm glad it has. I said, oh my God, here is the modern day Thomas Jefferson. I'll tell you a crazy story about how I got my start at Fox. I have not hesitated for one bit to criticize George W. Bush. He has shown less fidelity to constitutional government than any president since Abraham Lincoln. But I bear a little responsibility for his election. Now, here's how this happened. It's December of 2000. We're in the 38th day of the 42-day recount. All vacations at Fox are canceled. All weekends at Fox are canceled. I'm sleeping on the couch in my office. We're going 24/7, round the clock live, and I'm the expert in Florida election law. And one night, I'm on air with Britt Hume. I'm in New York. He's in D.C. Through the magic of television, it looks like we're in the same room. And all of a sudden, in the middle of he and I talking, you know, one of those swoosh alerts that Fox does about 8 or 9 times a minute, it seems. One of those alerts comes down, and the alert is that the Florida Supreme Court has just come down with its third ruling on the recount. And it has ordered that the recount resume not only in the four counties that Al Gore, this will all come back to you, has challenged, but in all 70 counties of the state of Florida. People are ready to pull their hair out. They want this thing to be over with. And we understand that Governor Bush's lawyers are going to appeal this decision of the Supreme Court of Florida to the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit in Atlanta, Hume says to me. What do you think about that? And I said, well, that's wrong. The Court of Appeals, without getting too technical, in Atlanta does not have jurisdiction to hear an appeal from the Florida Supreme Court. And he said, well, what should Bush's people do? I said, they should get in their cars and drive to Georgetown, which is where Justice Anthony Kennedy lives. He hears emergent appeals from the area of the United States where Florida is, and they should knock on the door of his house and file an emergency appeal. And with the stroke of a pen, he can stop the decision of the Florida Supreme Court and then pull the other eight justices. End of Hume's show. I go upstairs to take a nap, because in 3 hours I'm on with O'Reilly. You need all the rest you can get for that. At 7 o'clock, my ever-garrulous, ever-charming, ever-freedom-loving colleague Shepard Smith comes on, and another one of those swoosh alerts. And the alert is this. Lawyers for Governor Bush have just been cited in Georgetown, looking for the house of Justice Anthony Kennedy. And then, as only Shep can do, he looks in the camera and he goes, do you know what this means? This means that George W. Bush is watching Fox. And he's getting his legal advice from Judge Napolitano. And the rest is history. I have a couple of beliefs, firm beliefs, which Jefferson called truisms. A truism is something that is so obvious it doesn't have to be proven. And here they are. The first of my truisms is that God created every human being on the planet in his own image and likeness. And because he is perfectly free, he has created us in a state of perfect freedom. And that in order to protect those freedoms, and for no other purpose, we have established a government. And the only legitimate role of the government is to protect human freedom. Every individual has an immortal soul, capable of glorifying God infinitely and eternally. The government is just an artificial organization based on fear and force. If you don't believe me, you can take the words of the first two American presidents. George Washington said it was based on force, and John Adams said it was based on fear. I think they knew what they were talking about. Now, there was a time when everybody in America believed all of this. Tom Woods has just given us a brilliant and succinct analysis of how we lost these beliefs and consequently lost the freedoms that the beliefs animated. I'm going to tell you some stories that are even gloomier. There is a happy ending, but the stories are gloomy. You know all these things. We start out as colonists. We start out with a king and a parliament that wants money from us. What else do governments want besides power and money? So that, and our children. The government, the parliament enacts the Stamp Act, and the Stamp Act requires that every piece of paper in your possession, every book, every deed, every mortgage, every lease, every poster you're going to nail to a tree has to have a stamp on it. You had to go to a British government office in the colonies and buy the king's stamp. Question. How did the king know if every piece of paper in your possession had the king's image on it? Answer. The Parliament enacted the Writs of Assistance Act. What the heck did that do? That let British soldiers write their own search warrants. It authorized them to authorize themselves to enter any home, any building, any dwelling, ostensibly for the purpose of looking for the stamps. Of course, while they were there, they frequently helped themselves to what they wanted, including the home itself. We fought a revolution. We won the revolution. We wrote a constitution. But before we wrote it, we had an argument. The argument was in Philadelphia in 1787, where it was hotter than it is here in Galveston today. And the argument was this. Where do our freedoms come from? There was, even in Philadelphia in 1787, a big government crowd. You know their names. Alexander Hamilton, John Adams. These guys argued that our freedoms come from the government. That the government is the one that says we can speak freely and travel freely and worship as we wish. And as long as the government says that and the government is compelled to say that, we're safe. Jefferson, who wasn't there, but Madison, who was, made the argument that our freedoms come from our humanity, not from the government. That as God created us in His image and likeness, freedom is our birthright. It is as natural to us as the fingers on the ends of our hands or the nose in the middle of our face. The argument that freedom is our birthright was not a new one. Jefferson had made the same argument 12 years earlier when he wrote in the Declaration of Independence that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When he wrote that, and when every single delegate to the Constitutional Congress pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honors to support that, he wedded the American soul to the concept of natural rights. That, our right to think as we wish, to say what we think, to publish what we say, the right to worship as we see fit, the right to protect ourselves even against the government. Just as an aside, you know what that means? That means if the state of Texas or the state of New Hampshire authorizes you to carry a gun, you can carry that gun no matter who walks into that room. I don't even know that kid's name, but he's a new American hero. Back to the litany of rights. The most unique American right after the right to life is the right to be left alone. Thus, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution says the government can't write its own search warrants, can't knock on your door, can't break it down, can't arrest you, can't take your property, can't look at your personal papers, effects, or things, unless they present real evidence of real crime to a judge. So the Constitution puts a neutral judge between the government and the government's target. No matter how guilty is the target, no matter how threatening is the target, no matter how feared is the target, no matter how widespread is the belief in the guilt of the target, any government and every government that wants to get to that target must first go to a judge and present evidence of probable cause. That's what the law used to be. Until a president from the Lone Star State persuaded the supposedly freedom-loving Republican Party that it could do away with the Fourth Amendment. Remember the Writs of Assistance Act? We fought against a king when his soldiers knocked on our doors with self-written search warrants. The most abominable piece of legislation since the Alien and Sedition Acts, which made it a crime to criticize everybody in the government but the vice president, because the vice president was Thomas Jefferson, who welcomed their criticism. But the most abominable piece of contemporary legislation is the Patriot Act. You think that the Fourth Amendment protects you? Look again, the Patriot Act lets federal agents write their own search warrants. And the Patriot Act makes it a felony for the recipient of those search warrants to tell anyone. Let me get this straight. What part of Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech? What part of the people shall be secure in their persons, places, houses, and things does the Congress not understand? The Bush administration prosecuted an 86-year-old librarian because an FBI served her with a self-written search warrant to find out who had borrowed books from a public library, and she told her 74-year-old assistant. So they prosecuted her for speaking. They have made it a crime to tell the truth. Question in an open courtroom to the 86-year-old lady under oath. Did you receive a self-written search warrant? If she answers yes and tells the truth, she goes to jail for 5 years for speaking the truth. That's the nature, the insidious nature, the damnable nature of this piece of legislation that the Congress has imposed on us and which, regrettably, my dear friends, is still the law today. None of them read it. I spoke to a group of members of Congress in another state, not far from here. I don't even want to tell you who it is. And some of them came up to me afterwards and said, well, we voted for this thing, but we didn't know that it let federal agents write their own search warrants or that it made a crime for people to tell anyone. So I asked the question that you all know the answer to. Did you read it? No, of course not. In the case of the Patriot Act, they actually have an excuse for not reading it, because the Republican leadership in the House took this 315-page piece of legislation, which I have read three times and which takes 20 hours to read, and put it on the House intranet, the internal internet for House members and their senior staff, for 15 minutes before it was time to vote. And the Attorney General told the House of Representatives, there's a terrorist behind every bed bug and under every tree and next to every toilet, and we have to can't worry about these fine points of the Constitution. We need these powers to go after these people now. There have been 6 prosecutions under the Patriot Act. 3 have been for pornography, 2 have been for corruption, and 1 was the old librarian from Bridgeport. Has any of that made you safe? Of course not. But it has made you less free. Now, this did not start with George W. Bush. It started with John Adams, the Alien and Sedition Act. Think about it, the very same generation. and in many cases the very same human beings that wrote, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech," just 9 years later enacted legislation that authorized the punishment of speech. Jefferson allowed the statute to expire, but human beings were put in real jails hotter than this room we're in today because they dared to criticize the president. And several of them were put in jails for criticizing the president's enormous waistline. When Jefferson was president, he caused the Congress to enact legislation which purported to pay them back for their time in jail. That's how odious he found it. But this idea that the American Republic, the American constitutional form of government, is the greatest force for good in the Western world only makes sense if the guarantees in the Constitution are real guarantees, and if the people that we elect to the government really believe this. When I was on the bench and lawyers would come before me from the government, whether they were prosecutors in criminal cases or whether it was a civil case where somebody sued the government because a policeman ran them over or they fell on the sidewalk, I can't remember the government asking me to enforce the Constitution. The government asks judges to avoid and evade the Constitution because the government hates freedom. Freedom is an obstacle to the government's acquisition of power. And that's all the government wants. I look around this room and I see so many bright and happy faces that are happy that we are part of this crusade. In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its maximum hour of danger. You are that generation! This is that hour! Now is that time! Whenever you deal with the government, take your cell phone and make sure it has a camera. Because the camera is the new gun. The same government that fears freedom fears the disinfectant of the light of day. And that's what the camera does to them. Occasionally, there are some of my former colleagues who wear black robes who have done the right thing. When the Bush administration said we can take people to Cuba because we don't have to obey the Constitution or the treaties or the laws, we can torture them, and best of all, we don't have to worry about those pesky federal judges, the Supreme Court, by a vote of 8-1, said you can't. When the Congress enacted legislation that said if the president declares you an enemy combatant, you don't have the right to habeas corpus, meaning you can't force the government to come before a neutral judge and justify its unlawful confinement of you, and the Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, said you can't. When the president said he could lock up Americans and throw away the key because they were too dangerous to talk to their parents, their spouses, their lawyers, or other prisoners, that he could keep them in jail for as long as he wanted without even charging them with a crime, by a vote of 6-3, the Supreme Court said, you can't. In fact, every single time that people took the Bush administration to the Supreme Court over its so-called war on terror, the government lost and freedom won. I remember having a debate with one of my more irritable colleagues And he said to me, now, what is your problem with this Patriot Act? And what's your problem with Gitmo? And I looked at him and I said, you know, you like all this stuff. Bush was president at the time. You like all this stuff because you trust the president. What happens when these powers are passed on to a president that you don't trust? And he looked at me and he said, well, when I am sent to Gitmo, will you come to visit me? And I said, Bill, no. Thomas More, one of my heroes, my personal patron saint, the patron saint of lawyers, was arguing in his own behalf, in his own trial, which we all know he lost, for treason. The act of treason, the alleged act of treason, was the refusal to agree that the king is the head of the church on earth. That was the act of treason. And More, in presenting his closing argument to the jury, said to them, some men say the earth is flat, and some men say it is round. But if it is flat, can the king's command make it round? And if it is round, can a law of parliament make it flat? He was, of course, appealing to the common sense of his jurors. He was also appealing to their understanding of the natural law, that our rights are ours by virtue of our humanity, that God has given order to certain events in the world, and there are things that the government can't change. And if our rights come from our humanity, then no law, no proclamation, no executive order, no command, no piece of legislation that no one has read but the printer who put it on paper can take those rights away. In World War I, Woodrow Wilson and the progressives arrested people that they called anarchists. They were mostly Eastern European Jews from Boston to Baltimore who spoke against the war. And they enacted legislation, which is still good law today, called the Espionage Act of 1917, which makes it a crime to speak against the government's war effort. When the New York Times, of which I'm not particularly fond, nevertheless revealed that the government was spying on people without warrants, something that the Attorney General under oath a year before had denied that they were doing, he threatened them. He threatened to prosecute them under the Espionage Act. Imagine that. The government was going to prosecute some newspaper for speaking the truth on the basis of a 1917 law written in an era of hysteria against Eastern European Jews. FDR locked up 150,000 Japanese Americans, and in New Jersey, 10,000 Italian Americans, not because they did or said anything, but because they belonged to a racial or ethnic group that he feared, that he feared might not be loyal. They were as American as he was. In fact, they were more American than he was. And, of course, we know that Abraham Lincoln slaughtered 600,000 Americans. His troops raped women, robbed banks, destroyed courthouses, burnt towns, and they all got away with it. All in the name of big government, of order, of safety. I hear the devil coming from around a tree, and the devil stopped to talk to me, and the devil said, give me your liberty, and I'll keep you safe. Don't ever let anyone make that diabolic bargain in your behalf. There is one fear. There is one fear that is a good fear. And Jefferson reminded us of it. When the people fear the government, that is tyranny. When the government fears the people, that is liberty. God bless you.